The last of Alfred's silver came, and the Danish army released the young hostages, including the Mercian twins, and the rest of us went back to Lundain. Ragnar dug up the pot with his younger son's ashes and carried it downstream on Wind Viper. "I shall take it home," he told me, "and bury him with his own people." We could not travel north that year. It was autumn when we reached Lundain, and so we had to wait through the winter. And it was not till spring that Ragnar's three ships left the Thames and sailed north. I was 15 then, and growing fast, so that I was suddenly a head taller than most men, and Ragnar made me take the steering oar. He taught me to guide a ship, how to anticipate the buffet of wind or wave, and how to heave on the steering oar before the ship veered. I learned the subtle touch, though at first the ship swayed drunkenly as I put too much pressure on the oar. But in time I came to feel the ship's will in the long oar's shaft, and learned to love the quiver in the ash as the sleek hull gained her full speed. "I shall make you my second son," Ragnar told me on that voyage. I did not know what to say. "I shall always favour my eldest," he went on, meaning Ragnar the younger, "but you shall still be as a son to me." "I would like that," I said, awkwardly. I gazed at the distant shore that was flecked by the little dun sails of the fishing boats that were fleeing from our ships. "I am honoured," I said. "Uthred Ragnarsson," he said, trying it out. And he must have liked the sound of it, for he smiled. But then he thought of Rorik again, and the tears came to his eyes, and he just stared eastward into the empty sea. That night we slept in the mouth of the Humber, and 2 days later came back to Jofurik. The king's palace had been repaired. It had new shutters on its high windows, and the roof was freshly thatched with golden rye straw. The palace's old Roman walls had been scrubbed so that the lichen was gone from the joints between the stones. Guards stood at the outer gate, and when Ragnar demanded entry, they curtly told him to wait, and I thought he would draw his sword. But before his anger could erupt, Kjartan appeared. "My lord Ragnar," he said sourly. "Since when does a Dane wait at this gate?" Ragnar demanded. "Since I ordered it," Kjartan retorted, and there was insolence in his voice. He, like the palace, looked prosperous. He wore a cloak of black bear fur, had tall boots, a chainmail tunic, a red leather sword belt, and almost as many arm rings as Ragnar. "No one enters here without my permission," Kjartan went on. "But, of course, you are welcome, Earl Ragnar." He stepped aside to let Ragnar, myself, and three of Ragnar's men into the big hall, where 5 years before my uncle had tried to buy me from Ivar. "I see you still have your English pet," Kjartan said, looking at me. "Go on seeing while you have eyes," Ragnar said carelessly. "Is the king here?" "He only grants audience to those people who arrange to see him," Kjartan said. Ragnar sighed and turned on his erstwhile shipmaster. "You itch me like a louse," he said, "and if it pleases you, Kjartan, we shall lay the hazel rods and meet man to man. And if that does not please you, then fetch the king, because I would speak with him." Kjartan bridled, but decided he did not want to face Ragnar's sword in a fighting space marked by hazel branches, and so with an ill grace he went into the palace's back rooms. He made us wait long enough, but eventually King Egbert appeared, and with him were six guards, who included one-eyed Sven, who now looked as wealthy as his father. Big, too, almost as tall as I was, with a broad chest and hugely muscled arms.